our sight. Minayar brought much sadness to Fingil and his tribe. For all, it was a mighty weapon.
He took a swallow of water to clear his throat. Ysadra tenderly watched his face, her hand atop his.
We told to you that our witnesses have stood unused for centuries of silence. Then, little more than 1 year ago, the Shard spoke to us. Or rather, something spoke to us through the Shard, as in the elder days. That which spoke was someone or something who we knew not. Something that used the speak fire in the old Dwaro home of Hike Ikeyo. Something that talked to us in gentle and persuasive words. Strange enough was it to hear Shard and speak fire talking as of old. But we also remembered the evil that had driven our fellows from their home. An evil of which you mortals need not hear, for it would throw you into great fear. So we trusted this stranger not. Also, as long as it had been since we had last used the witnesses, still some of us remembered the elder days and what it felt like when the Zedaya did speak to us then. This was not the same. Whatever stood before the speak fire in the north seemed more like a cold breath of unbeing than a living creature, for all its kindly words.
Ysadra moaned softly beside him. Maegwin, caught up in the Dwaro's story despite herself, felt a chill travel through her.
That which spoke, Ysfidri continued, wished to know of the sword Mineya. It knew we had been the blade's makers, and it knew that we Dwaros are bound to our work, even after it has gone from us. As one who has lost a hand often feels it still at the end of his arm. The thing that spoke to us from witness to witness asked if the northern king Fingil had indeed taken the sword Minyar into Aswa when he conquered that great place, and was it there still? Aswa, Ayala breathed. Of course, the Hayholt. That is its mortal name.
Ysfidri nodded.
We were frightened by this strange and fearful voice. You must understand, we have been as castaways for more years than your people can dream. It was obvious that some new power had arisen in the world, but one that nevertheless did command the old arts. But we do not wish any of our old masters to find us and take us back. So at first we made no answer.
The Dwaro leaned forward on his padded elbows.
Then, a short time ago, a few of the moon woman's changes, as you would reckon it, beneath the sky. The Shard spoke again. This time it did speak with the voice of the eldest of the Scythi, the voice you heard. She also asked us of Minayar. With her also, we were silent.
Because you fear they will make you their servants again?
Yes, Herdsman. Unless you have ever fled from bondage, you will not understand that terror. Our masters are ageless. We are not. They retain the old lore. We diminish.
Ysfidri rocked back and forth on his stool, the ancient leather of his garments rubbing and squeaking like crickets.
But we knew something neither of our questioners did,
he said finally. There was a gleam in his round eye, unlike anything the surface dwellers had yet seen.
Do you see? Our masters think the sword Minyar never left Aswa. And that is true. But the one who found the sword there beneath the castle, the one you call King John Prester, had it reforged and made new. Under the name of Bright Nail, he carried it all across the world and back.
The Count of Nad Mullach whistled, a low, surprised trill. So Bright Nail was the old scourge of the north, Fingal's Minear. Strange. What other secrets did Prester John take to his grave about the Kinslaw, I wonder? He paused. But, Ysfidri, still, we do not understand.
Patience.
The Duero showed a wintry smile.
You could never tend and harvest bulky stone as we do. You quick-blooded children. Patience.
He took a breath.
The mistress of the Zedaya told us that this sword, one of the great swords, was somehow much concerned with events now transpiring, and with the fate of the mortal prince named Handless Joshua.
Joshua Lackhand?
Yes. But we think that is trickery. For she also said that this sword might be somehow vital against that same evil that had driven our tribesfolk out of Hike Hikeo, and that the same evil soon might threaten all that walked above or below ground. How could the fate of any mortal man affect the squabblings of immortals?
The Duero's voice quavered.
It is another trap to play on our fear. She wishes us to seek her help, so we will fall into their clutch once more. Did you not hear her? Come to us at Zhao E Tunake. Was ever a trap more cold-bloodedly baited before the victim's eyes?
So, the Count said at last, somehow Joshua's survival is tied to this blade. Ysfidri shot him a worried glance.
So she claimed. But how could she say his fate is tied to that of Minear, when she did not even know it had been reforged? She said that none but us did know this thing, and that possibly many fates, perhaps the threads of all fate, were tied to three great swords, of which Minear was one.
Ysfidri stood, a haunted look upon his face.
And I will tell you a terrible, terrible thing,
he said miserably.
Even though we cannot trust our once masters, we fear that they may be telling the truth. Mayhap, a great doom has come into the world. If so, we Duero's may have brought it on.
Ayla looked around, struggling to make sense of what he had heard. But why, Ysfidri? Bright Nail's history might be a deep and dark secret. But you, Duero's, did not tell it to anyone. When the Shard spoke to us, we said nothing of it. Because we did not know the tale, no secrets have been told. What doom have you brought on? The Duero was deeply pained.
I did not tell you all. One last time before your arrival, the Shard called to us. It was the fearsome stranger from Hike Hikeo, asking again of the sword Minear, that cursed sword.
He slumped bonelessly back onto the stool.
This time, there was only one of us at the site of witness, young Chauvene, who you have met. He was alone, and the voice laid a great fear upon him. It threatened, then it promised, then threatened again.
Ysfidri slapped his wide palm on the table.
You must understand, He was afraid. We are all afraid. We are not what we were.
He lowered his eyes as if shamed, then looked up to find his wife's gaze. He seemed to gain courage.
At last, Chauvenet's terror did overwhelm him. He told the stranger the tale of Miniar, of how it was reforged and became Brightnail.
Ysvedri shook his great head.
Poor Chauvenet. We should never have let him stand watch at the Shard alone. May the Garden forgive us. Do you see, Johann's folk, how former masters may have lied to us? But still we fear that no good can come out of the darkness in Hikeikeo. If the first grandmother of the Scythi has told the truth, who knows what power we have given to evil?
Maegwin hardly heard him. She was losing the thread of Ysvedri's speech, dully registering bits and pieces while her weary mind swirled with thoughts of her own failure. She had misunderstood the god's will. She needed to be free, to have time to herself, time to think. Count Eolair sat thinking for a long while. The room was full of brooding silence. At last, Ysvedri stood.
You have shared our table, he said. Let us show you our prizes. Then you may go back to the bright, airy surface.
Eolair and Maegwin, still silent, let themselves be led across the round room and through one of the doors. They followed the Dwaros down a long, sloping hallway before coming at last to a deeper chamber whose outer walls were as complicated as a maze, angling in and out so that everywhere Maegwin looked there were surfaces covered with carved stone.
In this chamber, and others below it, are the patterns,
Ysvedri said.
Long the Dwaros have delved, and widely. Every tunnel, every deep place we dug, is there. This is the history of our folk, and we too are the keepers of it.
He waved his hand proudly.
Maps of bright Kementari, the labyrinth of Chinna Senne, the tunnels beneath the mountains Rimmersmen call Vestiveg, and those that honeycomb the mountains above our heads, all here. The catacombs of Ze Imiritha are long buried and silent, but here they live.
Eolair turned slowly, looking from surface to surface. The interior of the great chamber was as intricate as a many-faceted stone. Each facet, every angle and niche, was covered with delicate maps carved into the living stone.
And you said that you have maps of the tunnels that run here? Throughout the Greensborg?
He asked slowly.
With certainty, Count Eolair, Ysvedri said.
Being among the patterns seemed to have restored life to his sagging frame.
Those and more.
If we could have those, it would be a great help to us in our own struggle.
Maegwin turned on the Count, irritation finally bubbling to the surface.
What? Shall we carry 1,000 weight of stone up to our caves? Or climb down here to this lost place every time we must choose a fork in the path?
No, said Eolair, but like the Aedonite monks, we could copy them onto parchment, and so have them where we need them.
His eyes shone.
There must be tunnels we never dreamed of.
Our raids on Skali's camps will truly seem like magic.
See, Maegwin, you have brought great assistance to your people after all. A help greater than swords and spears.
He turned to Ysvedri. Would you allow us to do such a thing? Worried, the Dwaro turned to his wife. As the sound of their conversation chimed back and forth, Maegwin watched the Count. Aelair was walking from wall to wall, squinting up at the angled walls and their beetle-busy carvings. She fought a rising tide of anger. Did he think he was doing her a kindness when he complimented her on this discovery? She had been looking for help from the shining, legendary Scythi, not a gaggle of scarecrows with their dusty tunnel maps. Tunnels? Maegwin had been the one who had rediscovered the tunnels in the first place. How dare he try and placate her? As she felt herself caught between fury and loneliness and loss, a sudden realization cut through her confused thoughts like a knife. Aelair must go away. She could have no peace. She could never understand what the gods meant her to do, as long as he was around. His presence turned her into a child, a whining, moody thing, unfit to lead her people out of these dangerous straits. Ysfydri turned at last.
My wife and I must speak with our people before anything can be decided. This would be a new thing and could not be done lightly.
Of course, said Aelair. His voice was calm, but Maegwin could hear the suppressed excitement. Of course. Whatever may be best for your people. We will go away now and come back to you in a day or two, or whenever you say. But tell them that it will perhaps save Hearn's folk, whom the Dwarrows often helped before. The Hernistiri have never thought anything but good of you. Maegwin had another thought.
Are there tunnels near the Hayholt?
Ysadra nodded.
Yes, Aswa, as we call it, was delved deep as well as built high. Now its bones lie beneath the castle of mortal kings. But the earth underneath that castle is still alive with our diggings.
And are those maps here, too?
Of course, the Dwarrow replied proudly.
With a satisfied nod, Maegwin turned on the Count of Nad Mullach.
There, she said, that is the final answer I sought. A course lies open before us. We would be traitors to our own folk not to take it.
She lapsed into grave silence. Aelair rose to the bait. What do you mean, princess?
You must find Joshua, Count Aelair, she said abruptly.
She was pleased at the calm authority in her voice.
You heard what Ysfydri said at the table. This matter of the sword is of utmost importance. I was already thinking that Prince Joshua must be informed, in case there is a chance this knowledge can be used to defeat Elias. You and I know that as long as the High King prospers, Scarly Sharpnose will remain at our necks like a knife. Go find Joshua and tell him the secret of the sword. That will be the deed that saves our people.
In truth, Maegwin did not quite remember all the details of the Dwarrow's tale. She had been occupied with her own dire thoughts. But she remembered that it had something to do with Joshua and his father's sword. Aelair was astonished.
Go to Joshua? What do you say, lady? We have no idea where he is, or if he even lives. Do you ask me to leave our people in their need to go rabbiting off on such a fool's mission?
You claimed you heard that he was alive, she responded coldly. Only a short while ago, you were lecturing me on the chance of his survival. Can we afford to assume he is dead?
It was hard to tell from his practiced expression what he was thinking. Maegwin took a breath before beginning again.
In any case, Count Aelair, you fail to see the full importance of what these folk have told us. Maps of our tunnels are important, yes, but we can now send to Joshua maps of Elias' stronghold and of the secret entrances that could be the High King's undoing.
Listening to herself, it did suddenly seem like a good plan.
You know that Scarly will never loosen his grip on our land as long as Elias rules at his back in the Hayholt.
Aelair shook his head.
Too many questions, my lady. Too many questions. There is merit in what you say, certainly. Let us think about it. It will take us days to make semblances of all these maps. Surely it will be better if we consider it carefully. If we talk with Creovan and the other knights. Maegwin wanted to set the hook now, while Aelair was hesitating. She feared that more time would mean time for the Count to think of another solution, and for her to sink back into her inclarity of purpose. Being near him made her heart heavy as stone. She needed him to go away. She felt it now as a deep longing. She wanted him gone, so the pain and confusion would stop. How was it he could cloud her wits this way? She made her face cold. I do not like your resistance, Count. In fact, you seem to be doing precious little here. If you have time to follow me down holes in the ground, you might be better employed on a task that has some chance of saving us from our current situation. Maegwin smiled, purposefully mocking. She was proud of how well she hid her true feelings. But this cruelty, however necessary, filled her with horror.
What kind of creature am I becoming?
She wondered, even as she carefully watched Aelair's reaction.
Is this statecraft?
She felt a moment of panic.
Am I being a fool? No. It is better he goes away. But if this is how kings and queens must see their wills accomplished, Bakba's heard, what a terrible thing.
Aloud, she added, Besides, Count, you are pledged to my father's house, just in case you had forgotten. If you wish to flaunt the first request Luth's daughter has made of you, I cannot prevent you. But the gods will know and judge. Aelair started to speak. Maegwin lifted a hand to stop him, a very dirty hand she could not help noticing. I will not argue with you, Count Aelair. Do as you are told, or do not. That is all. Aelair's eyes narrowed, as though he saw her truly for the first time, and did not like what he now saw. His contemptuous expression leaned against her heart, like an impossibly heavy stone. But there was no turning back. The Count waited a long time before answering. Very well, lady, he said quietly. I will do as you command. I do not know where this sudden fancy, it seems a kind of madness, has come from. If you had asked my counsel in this thing and treated me as your family's friend instead of a vassal, I would have heeded your wish happily. Instead, you will have my obedience. But there will be little love with it. You thought to act the queen, but instead you have proved yourself only a callow child, after all.
Be silent, she said hoarsely.
The Dwarrows stared at Aelair and Maegwin curiously, as if they performed a quaint but inscrutable pantomime. The lights of the Patton Hall dimmed for a moment, and shadows grew monstrously tall among the labyrinthine walls of stone. A moment later the pale light flared once more, illuminating the darker corners. But a certain shadow had taken up residence in Maegwin's heart, and would not be dismissed. The Aedhna Cloud's crew did not handle Miriamel and Cadrach gently, as they routed the pair of them from the hold. But neither were they especially brutal. The sailors seemed more than a little amused by such an unexpected couple of stowaways. As the captives appeared beneath the lightning sky, the crewmen jeered mockingly, speculating on the vices of monks who took young women as companions, and on the virtue of young women who allowed themselves to be so taken. Miriamel stared back defiantly, undaunted by their rough manners. Despite the well-known sailor's custom of going bearded, many of the Cloud's crew were smooth-cheeked, not yet old enough to grow whiskers. She herself had seen more in a year, she felt sure, than these youths had seen in their whole lives. Still, it was clear
The Aedna Cloud was no plodding merchantman, no carrack bobbing like a washing tub as it carefully hugged the coastline, but a lithe ocean rider. A child of river-fronted and sea-wrapped Merrimond, Miriamel could tell the ship's quality just by the sprightly way the deck rolled beneath her feet, and by the sound of the white sails crackling overhead, as they drank deeply of the daybreak wind. An hour earlier, Miriamel had despaired. Now she found herself taking great breaths, her heart rising once more. Even a whipping from the captain would be bearable. She was alive and upon the open sea. The sun was rising into the morning sky, a beacon of continuing hope. A glance at the standard snapping on the mainmast confirmed that Cadrach had been correct. The Praven Osprey flew there, ochre and black. If only she had found more time to talk to Denevan, to find out more news of the Nabonne court and where the Praven house and others stood. She turned to whisper a warning to Cadrach about the need for secrecy, but was brought up sharply before a wooden stairway by the sailor at her side, who even in the stiff breeze smelled excessively of salt pork. The man on the quarterdeck turned to look down upon them. Miriamel, startled, sucked in a sharply audible breath of air. His was not a face she knew, nor did he seem to recognize her. He was, however, very, very handsome. Dressed in black breeches, jacket and boots, each minutely wrought with gilt piping, with a brilliant cloth of gold cape swirling around him, and the wind blowing his golden blonde hair. This strange nobleman seemed a sun god out of ancient legends. "Kneel down, you louts," one of the sailors hissed. Cadrach dropped immediately. Miriamel, nonplussed, complied more slowly. She was unable to take her eyes off the golden man's face. "These are they, Lord," the sailor said, "the ones the Niski found. As you see, one's a girl."
"As I see," the man replied dryly.
"You two remain kneeling,"
he directed Miriamel and Cadrach.
"You men, go. We need more sail if we are to make Grenaman tonight." "Yes, Lord."
As the sailors moved off hurriedly, the one they called Lord turned to finish his conversation with a burly, bearded man that Miriamel guessed was the captain. The nobleman glanced at the prisoners once more before making his leonine way off the quarterdeck. Miriamel thought his eyes might have lingered on her, longer than curiosity alone would dictate, and felt an unfamiliar tingle run through her, half fear, half excitement, as she turned to watch him go. A pair of manservants scurried after him, trying to keep his wind-whipped cloak from snagging on anything. Then, for a brief instant, the golden-haired man looked back. Catching her eye, he smiled. The burly captain stared down at Cadrach and Miriamel with poorly hidden disgust.
"Earl says he'll decide what to do with you after his morning meal," he growled, then spat expertly with the wind. "Women and monks, what could be worse luck? And especially in these times, I'd throw you over if the master didn't happen to be aboard."
Who is the master of this ship?" Miriamel asked quietly.
"You don't recognize the crest, Uxie. You didn't recognize my lord when he was standing in front of you. Aspites Previs, Earl of Drina, and Aedna is master of this ship, and you'd better hope he takes a liking to you, or you'll find yourself sleeping in kilpa beds."
He spat more grey citral juice. Cadrach, already pale, looked ill at the captain's words. But Miriamel barely heard. She was thinking of Aspites' golden hair and bold eyes, and wondering how in the midst of such danger she could suddenly feel so unexpected.
"Never know where the boy went, or why he won't answer us. We have been shouting for hours."
Binnebik shook his head morosely.
"That is what gives me the most worry.
We did not go far before finding his horse. Half of a league at the most. We have been twice that distance now, and most of the way returning, but still no sign of Simon is there to see.
The Rimmer's man squinted into the flurrying snow.
Come, if he's fallen off, he'd probably make his way back down his own tracks, while they lasted. Let's drag the wolf a little farther. Head back toward the abbey. All the way back, this time. Maybe if she actually smells the boy close by, she'll do better.
He urged his mount and the trailing pack horses forward. Binnebeck grimaced and whistled for Kantaka. The wolf came reluctantly.
I am not liking this storm that comes, the troll called.
Only a short distance ahead, the Rimmer's man had already become a bulky blur.
Not any bit. This is the outrider for the darkness we saw gathering in the north near Stormspike. It is coming down with great swiftness.
I know it, Sludig shouted over his shoulder. Soon we will have to look to our own safety, whether we find the boy or not.
Binnebeck nodded, then thumped his hand sharply against his jacketed chest, once, twice, then a third time. Unless the gods of his people were watching, no one saw his anguished gesture. The abbey, lately the scene of such wild horror, had become a quiet, snow-draped sepulchre. The mounds of drifting snow obscured most signs of what had become of Skodi and her young charges, but could not hide all. Kantaka would not approach within an arrow's flight of the silent walls. Binnebeck and Sludig themselves only crossed into the abbey's dooryard long enough to make certain that Simon was not one of the still, white-shrouded forms, then left hurriedly. When they had put 1,000 paces between themselves and the abbey, they stopped and stood silently for a while, sharing long swallows from a bottle of Kangkang as they listened to the mournful wind. Kantaka, obviously happy to be heading away from that dire place once more, sniffed briefly at the air before curling up at Binnebeck's feet.
"Holy Aiden, troll," Sludig said at last. "What manner of witch was that girl Skodi, anyway? I have never seen anything to match it. Was she one of the Storm King's followers?"
"Only in the way that those like her do what the Storm King wishes, whether they are knowing it or not. She had power, but she was hoping to become a power, which, I am thinking, is very different. A little Norn queen with her own little band of followers was what she was wishing to be. Times of war and strife are the arising times of new forces. The old order begins its changing, and those like Skodi appear, seeking to make a mark."
"I only thank blessed God for wiping out the whole nest of them to the smallest pup."
Sludig shivered and scowled.
"No good could have come from any of those witchlets surviving."
Binnebeck looked at him curiously.
"The innocent can be molded, as those children were. But sometimes luck is granting that they can be molded back. I have little belief in evil beyond redeeming, Sludig."
"Oh," the Rimmersman laughed harshly. "What about your Storm King? What good could you possibly say about such a black-hearted hellspawn as that?"
"Once he loved his people more than his own life," Binnebeck said quietly.
The sun made a surprisingly swift crossing through the murky sky. By the time they halted again, early twilight was approaching. They had twice more covered the distance between the abbey and the spot in the deep woods that they had decided on as the outermost point. All their shouting and beating of bushes had been to no avail. Simon remained unfound, and now darkness and fresh storms were fast approaching.
"Aiden's blood," Sludig said in disgust, then patted Simon's grey mare, which was roped to the train of pack horses. "At least we did not lose the damnable sword as well."
He waved a hand at Thorn, but did not touch it. Where the black sword was visible through the loose swaddling, snowflakes lit upon its surface and slid away, leaving it free of the white that spattered everything else.
"It makes our decision more difficult, though. If the lad and the sword were lost together, we would have no choice but to search."
Pinnebik looked up with angry eyes.
"What decision do you speak about?"
"We can't very well abandon everything for the stripling troll. I'm fond of him, the good lord knows. But we have our duty to Prince Joshua. You and the other book readers keep saying that Joshua needs this blade, or we are all doomed. Should we ignore that to hunt for a lost boy? Then we would be more foolish than the boy was, for getting lost in the first place."
"Simon is not foolish."
Binnebik buried his face in the ruff of Kantaka's neck for a long moment.
"And I am tired of being an oathbreaker. I swore for his protection."
The troll's voice was muffled by the wolf's pelt, but the straining edge was unmistakable.
"We are forced to difficult choices, troll."
Binnebik looked up. His usually mild brown gaze had turned flinty.
"Do not be speaking to me of choices. Do not go teaching me about difficulty. Take this sword. On my master's grave I swore to protect Simon. To me, nothing else has more importance."
"Then you are the most foolish of all," Sludig growled. "We are down to two left, while the world freezes around us. Would you send me alone with the sword that could save your people and mine? Also, you need not be an oathbreaker to a dead master."
Binnebik straightened, his eyes brimmed with angry tears.
"Do not dare speak to me of my oath," he hissed. "I am taking no advice from a witless crowhawk."
Sludig raised a gloved fist as though to strike at the little man. The Rimmersman stared at his own trembling hand, then turned and stalked out of the clearing. Binnebik did not look up to see him go, but instead returned to stroking Kantaka's shaggy back. A tear ran down his cheek and vanished into the fur of his hood. Minutes passed without even a bird's cry.
"Troll?"
Sludig stood at the edge of the glade, just beyond the horses. Binnebik still would not look up.
"Listen, man," Sludig continued. "You must listen to me."
The Rimmersman still hung back, like an unexpected guest waiting to be invited indoors.
"Once, soon after we first met, I told you that you knew nothing of honor. I wish to go and kill Storfot, Thane of Vestvenby, for his insults to Duke Iskrimnor. You said I should not go. You said that my lord Iskrimnor had given me a task to perform, and that putting that task's fulfillment in jeopardy was neither brave or honorable, but foolish."
The troll continued to rub distractedly along Kantaka's back.
"Binnebik, I know you are honorable. You know I am the same. We have a bad choice to make. But it is not right that allies should fight and throw insults like stones at each other."
The troll still did not reply, but his hands fell from the wolf and into his lap. He crouched unspeaking for long moments, chin on chest.
"I have been disgracing myself, Sludig," he said at last. "You are right to be hurling my own words back into my face. I beg for your pardon, although I have done nothing for its deserving."
He turned an unhappy face up to the Rimmersman, who took a few steps back into the clearing.
We cannot afford to search for Simon forever, Sludig said quietly. That is a truth separate from love and friendship.
You are not wrong, Binnabik said. He shook his head slowly. Not wrong.
He stood and moved toward the bearded soldier, extending a small hand.
If you can show forgiving of my stupidity.
There is nothing to forgive.
His broad palm clasped Binnabik's, engulfing it. A weary smile flitted across the troll's face.
Then one favor there is, I will ask. Let us be making a fire here during tonight and tomorrow night, and we will call for Simon. If we are finding no trace of him, then the morning after tomorrow, we will walk on toward the Stone of Farewell. Otherwise, I will feel as though I have deserted him without proper searching.
Sludig nodded gravely.
Fairly spoken. Now, we should gather wood. Night is coming on quickly.
The cold wind is not lessening either, Binnabik said, frowning. An unhappy thought for all who are out of doors without shelter.
Brother Hengfisk, the king's unpleasant cupbearer, gestured to the doorway. The monk's grin was as derangedly fixed as ever, as though he struggled with some monstrous humor only barely held in check. The Earl of Utenyit stepped through the door, and silent Hengfisk scuttled away down the stairs, leaving the Earl standing just inside the bell chamber. Guthwulf took a moment to catch his breath. It was a very long climb up the tower steps, and the Earl had not been sleeping well lately.
"You called for me, Highness?" he said at last.
The king stood hunched over the sill of one of the high arched windows, his heavy cloak glinting in the torchlight like a fly's glass-green back. Although the afternoon was only half gone, the sky outside was evening dark, purple and sullen grey. The curve of Elias' shoulders made Guthwulf think of a vulture. The king wore the heavy grey sword scabbarded at his side. Seeing it, the Earl shivered uncontrollably.
"The storm is almost upon us," Elias said without turning. "Have you been this high in Green Angel Tower before?"
Guthwulf forced himself to speak casually.
"I have been in the entry hall. Perhaps once to the chaplain's rooms on the second floor. Never this high, sire."
"It is a strange place," the king said,
his gaze still fixed on something beyond the northwestern window.
"This place, Green Angel Tower, was once the center of the greatest kingdom Ostenard has ever seen. Did you know that, Guthwulf?"
Elias swung away from the window. His eyes were bright, but his face was drawn and lined, as though his iron crown was cinched too tightly about his brow.
"Do you mean your father's kingdom, Highness?"
the Earl asked, puzzled and more than a little fearful. He had felt only a kind of dread when he had received this latest summons. This man was no longer his old friend. At times the king seemed almost unchanged, but Guthwulf could not ignore the underlying reality. The Elias he had known might as well be dead. However, the gallows in Battle Square and the spikes atop the Nirola Gate were now crowded with the mortal remains of those who had upset this new Elias in some way or other. Guthwulf knew to keep his mouth well shut and do what he was told, at least for a while longer.
"Not my father's, idiot. For the love of God, my hand stretches over a far realer kingdom than his ever did. My father had King Luth on his very doorstep. Now there are no other kings but me."
Elias' moment of bad temper faded as he waved his arm expansively.
"No, Guthwulf, there are more things in this world than such as you can even dream of.
This was once the capital of a mighty empire, vaster than Fingil's greater Rimmersgard, older than the Naban of the Imperators, stronger in law than lost Candia. His voice sank so that it was almost lost in the call of the wind. But with his help, I will make this castle the seat of an even greater kingdom. Whose help, Highness? Garthwolf could not refrain from asking. He felt a surge of cold jealousy. Priorities? Elias looked at him oddly for a moment, then burst into laughter.
Priorities? Garthwolf, you are artless as a child.
The Earl of Utanyit bit the inside of his cheek to hold back the angry and potentially fatal words. He clenched and unclenched his scarred fists.
Yes, my king, he said at last.
The king was once more staring out the window. Above his head, the great bells slept in dark clusters. Thunder muttered somewhere far away.
But the priest does keep secrets from me, Elias said. He knows my power is growing, as my understanding increases. And so he tries to hide things from me. Do you see that, Guthwulf?
He pointed out the window.
Well, fires of hell, man, how can you see from there? The king snarled. Come closer. Do you fear the wind will freeze you?
He laughed strangely. Guthwulf reluctantly stepped forward, thinking of what Elias had been like before this insanity had begun to creep in. Quick-tempered, yes, but not inconstant as a spring breeze. Fond of jokes, but with the bluff humor of a soldier, not this mocking and incomprehensible wit. It was growing harder and harder for Garthwolf to recall that other man, his friend. Ironically, it seemed that the madder Elias became, the more he grew to resemble his brother Joshua.
There!
The king gestured across the damp rooftops of the Hayholt, toward the grey bulk of Hjeldin's tower, squatting along the inner bailey's northern wall.
I gave that to Priorates to use for his various endeavors, his investigations, if you will. And now he keeps it always locked. He will not even give a key to his king. For my safety, he says.
Elias glared across at the priest's brooding tower, grey as the sky, upper windows of thick red glass.
He is growing very proud, the alchemist.
Banish him, Elias, or destroy him,
Guthwulf spoke without thinking, then decided to press on. You know I have always spoken to you as a friend, blunt when it was needed. And you know I am no craven who whimpers when a little blood is spilled or a few bones are cracked. But that man is poisonous as a serpent, and far more dangerous. He will stab you in the back. Only say the word, and I will kill him. When he finished, he found that his heart was racing, as in the hour before battle. The king stared for a moment, then laughed again.
Ah, there is the wolf I knew. No, no, old friend, I told you once before, I need Priorates, and I will use whatever I need to perform the grand task before me. Neither will he stab me in the back, for you see, he needs me too. The alchemist uses me, or thinks he does.
Thunder pealed again in the distance as Elias stepped away from the window and laid his hand on Guthwulf's arm. The Earl could feel the radiating cold right through his heavy sleeve.
But I do not want Priorates to kill you, the king said. And kill you he would. Make no mistake. His courier arrived today from Naban. The letter tells me that negotiations with the Lector are going very well, and that Priorates will be back in a few days. That is why it was a happy thought to send you out to the High Thrivings, at the head of my knights. Young Fengbald was pressing for the command, but you have always been of great service to me, and, more importantly, You will then be out of the Red Priest's path until he has done what I need.
I am grateful for the chance to serve my king,
Guthwulf said slowly, several kinds of anger and fear swelling venomously within him. To think that the Earl of Utanyit had come to such sneaking and bowing. What if he were to grab Elias, he thought suddenly, wildly, just grab the king and then fling himself over the window's low railing, both of them plunging down over 100 cubits to smash like eggs. Osiris the Ransomer, what a relief it would be to end this festering brain sickness that had crept all through the Hayhold and through Guthwulf himself. His mind reeled. Aloud, he only said, Are you sure that these rumors of your brother are not just that? Rumors only? The imaginings of complaining peasants? I find it hard to believe that anything could have survived. Could have survived Naglamund? One step, he thought, just one, then the two of them would be gliding down through the heavy air. It would all be over in moments, and the long, dark sleep would begin. Elias moved away from the window, breaking the spell. Guthwulf felt chill sweat beading on his forehead.
I do not heed rumors, my dear Utanyit. I am Elias the High King, and I know.
He stalked to a window on the tower's far side, one that faced southeast into the teeth of the wind. His hair swirled, black as a crow's wing.
There,
he pointed out across the choppy, leaden-hued Kinslaw into the murky distance. A flash of lightning briefly illuminated the deep wells of his eyes.
Joshua lives, indeed, and he is somewhere out there. I have received word from a trusted source.
Thunder came, chasing the lightning.
Priorities tells me my energies could be better spent. He tells me not to worry about my brother. If I had not seen 1,000 kinds of proof of Priorities' black and empty heart, I would think he felt sorry for Joshua. So strongly does he argue against this mission. But I will do as I please. I am the king, and I want Joshua dead.
Another lightning flare etched his face, which was twisted like a ritual mask. The king's voice strained. For a moment it seemed that only his white-knuckled grasp upon the stone sill kept him from toppling.
And I want my daughter back. Back! I want Miriamel back. She has disobeyed her father, joining with his enemies, with my enemies. She must be punished.
Guthwulf could think of nothing to say. He nodded his head, trying to dispel the terrible thoughts that now surged within him, like a well filling with black water. The king and his cursed sword. Even now Guthwulf felt the blade's presence sickening him. He would go to the Thrithings and hunt for Joshua, if that was what Elias wished. At least he would be out of this horrible castle with its night sounds, its fearful servants, and mad mourning king. He would be able to think again. The Earl would breathe unsullied air and keep the company of soldiers once more, men with whose thoughts and conversation he was comfortable. Thunder rang through the chamber, setting the bells to humming.
I will do as you say, my king, he said.
Of course, Elias nodded, calm again. Of course.
Scowling Guthwulf had gone away, but the king stayed for some time, staring out into the cloudy sky, listening to the wind as carefully as if he understood its mournful tongue. Rachel, mistress of chambermaids, was beginning to feel very uncomfortable in her cramped hiding place. Still, she had learned what she needed to know. Her mind was full of ideas quite beyond her usual concerns. Lately, Rachel the dragon had found herself thinking thoughts she had never dreamed possible. Wrinkling her nose against the harsh but familiar scent of polishing grease, She peeked out of the crack between the stone doorframe and the warped wooden door. The king was still as a statue, gazing off into nothingness. Rachel was again filled with horror at her own transgression. Spying like the most slatternly, brought in just for the holy day's servant girl. And on the High King. Elias was the son of her beloved King John, even if he couldn't hope to match up to his father. And Rachel, the Hayhalt's last bastion of rectitude, was spying on him. The thought made her feel faint and weak. The odoriferous grease did not help. She leaned against the wall of the bellringer's closet, and was grateful for its narrow confines. Between the stacks of rope, the bell hooks and grease pots and brick wall standing close at either shoulder, she could not topple over, even if she tried. She had not meant to spy, of course, not really. She had heard the voices as she was examining the woefully dirty stairs at Green Angel Tower's third floor. She had stepped quietly out of the spiraling passageway into a curtained alcove so as not to seem to be listening to the king's business, for she had recognized Elias' voice almost immediately. The king had climbed past, speaking as though to the grinning monk Hengfisk, who accompanied him everywhere. But his words had seemed like babbling nonsense to Rachel.
"Whispers from Nakiga," he had said, and "Songs of the Upper Air."
He had spoken of listening for the cry of the witnesses, and
the day of the hilltop bargain coming soon,
and of things even less understandable. The pop-eyed monk followed at the king's boot heels, as he always did these days. The mad words of Elias washed over him, but the monk only nodded ceaselessly as he scrambled along behind. The king's grinning shadow. Fascinated and excited in a way she had not felt for some time, Rachel had found herself following through the shadows a few ells behind the pair as they climbed what seemed 1,000 steps up the tower's long stairway. The king's litany of incomprehensibles had continued until at last he and the monk disappeared into the bell chamber. Feeling her age and the throbbing of her infirm back, she had remained on the floor below, leaning against the oddly tiled stone walls, fighting for breath. She had wondered again at her own boldness. An open workroom lay before her. A great pulley had been spread in pieces on top of a sawdust-mantled block. A sledge lay on the floor nearby, as though its owner had disappeared in mid-swing. There was only the main room and a curtained alcove beside the stairwell. Thus, when the monk suddenly came pattering back down the steps, there had truly been no choice but to bolt for the alcove. At the far end of the niche, she had discovered a wooden ladder leading up into darkness. Knowing she was caught between the king above and whoever his cupbearer might bring from below, she had seen no other choice but to climb upward in search of a more secure hiding place. Anyone walking too close to the alcove might brush the curtain aside and reveal her, delivering Rachel up to humiliation, or worse. Worse. The thought of the heads rotting like black fruit atop Nearuller Gate spurred her old bones up the ladder, which turned out to lead straight to the bellringer's closet. So it had not really been her fault, had it? She had not truly meant to spy. She had been virtually forced to listen to Elias' confusing conversation with the Earl of Utanyit. Surely good Saint Riap would understand, she told herself, and would intercede on Rachel's behalf when it came time to read from the great scroll in Heaven's anteroom. She peered out through the door crack again. The king had moved to another window, this one facing north, into the churning black heart of the approaching storm, but otherwise seemed no nearer to leaving. Rachel was beginning to feel panicky. People used to say that Elias spent many sleepless nights at work with Priorates in Hjeldin's tower. Was it the king's particular madness to walk around in towers until the break of dawn? It was only afternoon now. Rachel felt another bout of dizziness. Was she to be trapped in here forever? Her eyes, wildly darting, lit upon something carved on the inside of the bolted door and widened in surprise. Somebody had scratched the name Miriam Mell into the wood. The letters were cut deeply, as though whoever had done it had been trapped, like Rachel, fidgeting away the time. But who would be here in the first place that might do such a thing? For a moment she thought of Simon, remembering how the boy would climb like an ape and get into trouble that others could not even find. He had loved Green Angel Tower. Wasn't it just a bit before King John died that Simon had knocked over Barnabas the sexton downstairs? Rachel smiled faintly. The boy had been a very devil. Thinking of Simon, she abruptly remembered what the chandler's boy, Jeremias, had said. The smile dissolved from her face. Priorities. Priorities had killed her boy. When she thought of the alchemist, Rachel felt a hatred that burned and bubbled like quicklime, a hatred quite unlike anything she had ever felt in her life. Rachel shook her head, dizzied. It was horrifying to think about Priorities. What Jeremiah's told her about the hairless priest gave her ideas, black thoughts she had not known she was capable of thinking. Frightened by the power of her feelings, she forced her attention back to the wall carving. Squinting at the careful letters, Rachel decided that whatever other mischief Simon had gotten into, this carving was not his doing. It was far too neat. Even with Morgani's instruction, Simon's writing had wandered across a page like a drunken beetle. These letters were made by someone educated. But who would carve the princess' name in such an out-of-the-way place? Barnabas the sexton used this closet, no doubt, but the idea of that sour, juiceless, leathery old lizard carving Miriam L's name laboriously into the door beggared even Rachel's imagination. And Rachel could imagine men committing virtually any evil or stupidity if freed from the proper influence of women. Even so, Sexton Barnabas, as a pining lover, was too much to conceive. Her thoughts were wandering. Rachel chided herself angrily. Was she indeed so old and fearful that she must distract herself at a time when she had many important things to think about? A plan had been forming in her mind since the night she and the other chambermaids had rescued Jeremias. But a part of her wanted to forget about it, wanted things to just be the way they once were. Nothing will ever be the same, you old fool. Face up to it. It was harder and harder to hide from such decisions these days. Confronted with the runaway chandler's lad, Rachel and her charges had eventually realized that there was no solution but to help him escape. So they had smuggled him out of the hayhold one day's end, Jeremias disguised as a chambermaid returning home to Urchester. As she watched the ill-used boy go limping to safety, Rachel had been seized by a revelation. The evil haunting her home could be ignored no longer. And, she now thought grimly, where the mistress of chambermaids saw that which was foul, she must make it clean. Rachel heard the scuffling of heavy boots across the white stone floor of the bell chamber and risked a peek through the narrow opening. The king's green-cloaked form was just disappearing through the doorway. She listened as his steps descended and grew fainter, then waited a long while after they had passed from her hearing altogether, before she clambered back down the ladder. She stepped out from behind the curtain into the airiness of the stairwell, then patted at her forehead and cheeks, which were damp with perspiration despite the cold stone. Stepping carefully and quietly, she began to descend. The king's conversation had told her much that she needed to know. Now, she must only wait and think. Surely planning such a thing could not be half as complicated as commanding a spring cleaning. And in a way, that was what she planned, was it not? Her old bones aching, but her face stretched in an odd smile that would have set her chambermaids to shuddering. Rachel walked slowly down Green Angel Tower's endless stairway. Benedict's eyes would not meet Sludig's across the cookfire. Instead, the troll swept his sad pile of knucklebones back into their bag. He had cast them several times that morning. The results seemed to give him little pleasure. Sighing, the troll pocketed the sack, then turned and poked in the ashes of the fire with a stick, digging out their breakfast, a cache of nuts that he had located and dug from the frozen ground. It was a bitterly cold day, and their saddlebags were empty of food. Binnebik was not above stealing from squirrels.
"Do not speak,"
the troll said abruptly. After an hour of silence, Sludig had just opened his mouth.
"Please, Sludig, for a moment be saying nothing. Just the flask of Kenkeng from your pocket I am asking for."
The Rimmer's man sadly handed over the flask. Binnebik took a long swallow, then wiped the sleeve of his jacket across his mouth. The sleeve made another pass across the troll's eyes.
"A promise I made," he said quietly. "I was asking for 2 nights' fires, and you gave them. Now I must be fulfilling the oath that of all I would be most happily breaking. We must take the sword to the stone of farewell."
Sludig began to speak, but instead accepted the flask back from Binnebik and took a deep draught. Kantaka returned from a hunting foray to discover the troll and the Rimmer's man wordlessly bundling their few belongings onto the pack horses. The wolf watched them for a moment, then uttered a low moan of distress and danced away. She curled up at the edge of the clearing and peered solemnly at Binnebik and Sludig over the fence of her brushy tail. Binnebik lifted the white arrow out of the saddlebag and held it up, then pressed its wooden shaft against his cheek. The arrow shone more brightly than the powdery snow lying all around. He tucked the arrow back into the bag.
"I will be back for you,"
the little man said to no one present.
"I will find you."
He called for Kantaka. Sludig swung up into his own saddle, and they vanished into the forest, the string of pack horses following. The down-sifting snow began to fill in their footprints. By the time the muffled sounds of their passage faded, all trace of their presence in the clearing was gone. Sitting in one place, lamenting his fate, wasn't going to do him much good, Simon decided. In any case, the sky was becoming unpleasantly dark for mid-morning, and snow was beginning to fall more heavily. He stared ruefully at the looking-glass. Whatever Jiriki's mirror might be, the Scythi prince had spoken truth when he said that it would not bring him magically to Simon's side. He put it back in his cloak and stood up, rubbing his hands. It was possible that Binnebik and Sludig were still somewhere close by. Perhaps, like Simon, they had also been tumbled from their mounts and were in need of help. He had no idea how long he had lain helplessly in the grip of sleep, listening to the Scyther woman speaking through his dreams. It might have been hours or days. His companions could still be close by, or they might have given up on him. They could be leagues away. Pondering the bleak possibilities, he began walking in what he hoped was an expanding spiral, something he dimly remembered Binnebik suggesting as a good thing to do when people were lost. It was difficult to know if this spiral walking was exactly the right thing to do, however, since he was not sure precisely who was lost. Also, he had not paid particularly close attention when the little man had explained how one calculated this spiral. The troll's woodcraft lecture had concerned the movement of sun, the coloration of bark and leaves, the direction certain tree roots sprouted as they lay in running water. But at the time Binnebik had been explaining these things, Simon had been watching a three-legged lizard slowly limping along the Aldeorta forest floor. It was a shame Binnebik had not tried to make his explanation a little more interesting, Simon thought, but it was too late to do anything about it now. He tramped on through the thickening snowfall, as the sun rose invisibly behind the smother of clouds. The brief afternoon arrived, then almost immediately began preparing to leave. The wind blew and the storm seized Aldeota in its frosty fingers and squeezed. The cold jabbed at Simon through his cloak, which began to feel as thin as a lady's summer veil. It had seemed adequate while he was still in the company of friends, but when he thought about it, he could not remember the last time he had felt truly warm. As the day of unrewarded snow trudging dragged on, his stomach began to ache as well. He had last eaten in Skodi's house. The memory of the meal and its aftermath dislodged one of the few remaining shivers that the cold wind had not yet discovered. Who could say how much time had passed since then?
"Holy Aiden," he prayed, "give me food."
The thought became a sort of verse that echoed over and over in his head, in time with the crunching of snow beneath his boots. Unfortunately, this was a problem that would not go away by thinking of something else. Neither had it gotten as bad as it could get. Simon knew he could not get any more lost than he was at that moment, but he could become a great deal more hungry. In his time with Binnebik and the soldiers, he had gotten used to others doing the hunting and gathering. When he had helped, it was usually at someone else's direction. Suddenly, he was as alone as he had been during those first awful days in Aldeota, after he had fled the Hayholt. He had been dreadfully hungry then, and had survived until the troll found him. But that had not been winter weather. He had also been able to pilfer from isolated freeholdings. Now he wandered in a frozen and unpeopled wilderness that made his earlier sojourn in the forest seem an afternoon outing. The storm winds rose in pitch. The very air seemed to grow suddenly colder, sending Simon into a fresh spasm of trembling, as the forest began to darken ever so slightly, sending the first warning that even this weak daylight could not last forever. Simon found himself fighting back a rising surge of horror. All day long, he had tried to ignore the faint scrabbling of its claws. At times, he had felt as though he walked along the edge of an abyss, a pit which had no bottom, no limit. In a situation like this, Simon realized, it would be very easy to go mad, not to spring suddenly into arm-waving lunacy, like a beggar man ranting on Tavern Row, but rather to slip over into a quiet madness. He would make some unrecognized misstep and topple slowly, helplessly into the abyss, whose nearness seemed at that moment so unarguably clear. He would fall and fall, until he did not even remember he was falling anymore. His real life, his memories, the friends and the home he had once had, all would dwindle until they were nothing but ancient, dusty objects inside a head like a boarded-up cottage. Was that what dying was like? He suddenly wondered. Did a part of you stay in your body as in Skodi's ghastly song? Did you lie in the earth and feel your thoughts dwindling away bit by bit, like a sandbar broken down and carried off by a flowing stream? And now that he thought of it, would that be so terrible after all? To lie in the damp and dark and just slowly cease to be? Might it not be better than the frantic concerns of the living, the useless struggle against impossible odds, the panicky and pointless flight from death's ultimate victory? To give in. To just stop fighting. It had a pacific sound to it, like a sad but pretty song. It seemed a gentle promise, a kiss before sleeping. Simon was falling forward. Shocked into alertness, he threw out a hand and steadied himself against the trunk of a skeletal birch. His heart was beating very swiftly. He saw with astonishment that snow had gathered thickly on his shoulders and boots, as though he had stood in this place for a long time. But it had seemed like the merest instant. He shook his head and slapped at his cheeks with gloved fingers until the stinging brought life surging back through his body. He growled at himself. To almost fall asleep standing up? To freeze on your feet? What kind of a mooncalf was he? No. He growled again and shook his head. Binnabik and Sludig had said he was almost a man. He would not prove them wrong so easily. It was cold, and he was hungry, that was all. He would not cry and give up like a lowly apprentice scullion locked out of the kitchen. Simon had seen and done many things. He had survived worse than this. But what should he do? He couldn't solve the lack of food immediately, he knew, but that wasn't so bad. One thing Binnabik had said that Simon remembered very well was that a person could go a long time without food, but could not survive a single night in the cold without shelter. For this reason, the troll always said, fire was very, very important. But Simon had no fire, nor could he make one. As he considered this grim fact, he kept walking. Despite the fast increasing darkness, he hoped to find a better camping place before he stopped. The snow was falling faster now, and at the moment he was slogging along the bottom of a long, shallow canyon. He wanted to find higher ground, some place where he would not have to dig his way out if he survived the night. Thinking about this, Simon felt a painful smile form on his cracked lips. With the dreadful luck he had been having, the high place he chose would probably be struck by lightning. He laughed hoarsely, and was momentarily heartened by the sound of his own mirth. But the wind snatched it away before he could savor it. The spot he chose was a stand of hemlocks clustered atop a low hill, like white-caped sentries. He would have preferred the shelter of several large stones, or better still, a cave, but his luck was not so generous. He ignored the gurglings of his empty stomach as he briefly surveyed the little copse, then set to work pressing snow into hard lumps. These he piled between the trees on the windward side, pressing and smoothing them together until he had a serviceable wall that reached a little above his knees. As the last light started to bleed from the sky, Simon began pulling branches from the surrounding hemlocks. He piled them near the base of his snow bulwark until he had made a bed of springy needles nearly as high as the wall. Not yet content, he continued his way around the clearing, using his Canuck knife to cut branches by the handful until a pile of equal size lay beside the first. He stopped for a moment, breathing heavily, and felt the chill air suck the warmth away from his exposed face, as abruptly as if he had been fitted with a mask of sleet. Suddenly aware of the enormity of trying to stay warm during the wintry night to come, and of the fact that if he decided wrong, he might not wake up the following morning, he was spurred to a feverish renewal of his efforts. He shored up the snow wall, making it a little taller and much thicker, then built a lower wall supported by tree trunks on the other side of the first pile of branches. He raced around the copse, cutting more branches. His gloves were now so resinous that he could not separate the fingers and could only remove his hand from his knife by stepping on the blade first, until the height of both piles equaled that of his windward wall. By now it was almost too dark to see. Even the great trees were rapidly blurring into murky smudges against the near-luminous snow. He lay down on his bed of branches, bending his knees and pulling his long legs up against his body so that they would benefit as much as possible from being wrapped in his cloak, then began to pull the remaining branches over himself. He tried his best, with clumsy, sticky fingers, to weave them together so that there were no large exposed areas, and ended by reaching awkwardly up through the hemlock blanket to drag the last few branches over his head. He then turned his face sideways, so that it was mostly hidden in his hood. The position was miserably uncomfortable and unnatural in the extreme, but he could feel his own warm breath whispering in the pocket of the hood. For this little while at least, he stopped shivering. He had been so exhausted when he lay down that Simon expected to be asleep in a matter of moments, despite the tickling branches and his cramped legs. Instead, he found himself growing gradually more wakeful as the first hour of night wore on. The cold, while not as sharply biting as when he had earlier walked through the forest into the teeth of the wind, nevertheless sneaked through his meager shelter and seeped down into his bones and flesh. It was a dull and relentless sort of cold, patient as stone. The chill was bad enough, but though the thunder of his breathing and the drumbeat of his heart were loud in his ears, he could hear other, stranger noises as well. He had forgotten how differently the night forest sounded when no friend slept nearby. The wind moaned achingly through the trees. Other sounds seemed ominously stealthy, yet were loud enough to be heard, even above the lamenting wind. After all the horrors he had seen, he harbored no idle hopes that the night was innocent of dangers. Surely he was hearing damned souls crying in the storm, and lumbering Hunin prowling the forest in search of warm blood. As the night marched on, Simon felt black dread rising once more. He was all alone. He was a lost, doomed fool of a moon calf, who should never have dabbled in the affairs of his betters. Even if he survived the night, even if he was spared the clutches of some gibbering, faceless nightwalker, it would only be to starve in the daylight. Certainly he could last a few days, perhaps weeks if he was lucky. But from what Binnebik had told him, it was many leagues to the Stone of Farewell. And that was assuming that he knew how to get there at all, and could find his way through Aldeorta's unsympathetic depths to do so. Simon knew he did not possess the woodcraft to survive a long exile in the wild. He was no Jack Mundwoder, not even close. Similarly, there was almost no chance that anyone who could help would pass through this remote part of the northeastern forest, especially in such hellish weather. Worst of all, his friends were long gone. In the middle of the afternoon, he had suddenly found himself in a fit of panicky shouting, repeating their names over and over again until his throat felt rough as a butcher's block. At the last, just before his voice gave out, he thought he had been screaming the names of the dead. That was the most frightening thought of all. A path that ran very close to the abyss. Shout for the dead today, speak to them tomorrow, join them soon after. In a living death of irredeemable madness, if nothing else, and that might be worse than actually dying. He lay beneath the branches and shivered, but no longer from only the chill. Darkness rose within him, and Simon struggled against it. He didn't want to die yet, that he knew, but did it matter? There seemed to be nothing he could do about it one way or the other. "But I will not die here," he decided at last, pretending for a moment he had been offered some choice. He felt for his own desperation and began to smooth it down and push it back, quieting it like a frightened horse. "I've touched dragon blood. I won a sithy white arrow. It all means something, doesn't it?" He didn't know if it did all mean something, but he suddenly wanted very much to live. "I won't die yet. I want to see Binnebik again, and Joshua, and Miriamel. And I want to see Priorates and Elias suffer for what they did. I want a home again, a warm bed. Oh, merciful Osiris, if you really are real, let me have a home again. Don't let me die in the cold. Let me find a home. A home. Let me find a home." Sleep was conquering him at last. He seemed to hear his own voice echoing down an old stone well. At last he slid away from cold and painful thoughts into a warmer place. He survived that night and six more nights after it, each followed by a morning of terrible, frigid stiffness, of solitude and increasing hunger. The unseasonal cold had killed many of spring's children in the womb, but some plants had managed to bud and flower in the brief, false season of warmth before the deadly winter returned to stay. Binnabik and the Scythi had both given him flowers to eat, but Simon had no idea if they were right or wrong kinds of flowers. He ate what few he could find. They did not fill him up, but neither did they kill him. Patches of bitter yellow grass, very bitter, had survived beneath some of the snow hummocks as well, and he had made full use of all he could find. Once, in a moment of starved unreason, he had even tried to eat a handful of fir needles. They tasted astoundingly dreadful, and the sap and his own froth made a sticky, half-frozen mess on his downy beard. One day, when his longing for something solid to eat had become a maddening obsession, a chill, baffled beetle wandered across his path. Rachel the dragon had held a very firm line on the almost incalculable filthiness of such vermin. But Simon's stomach had become a far more powerful force than even Rachel's training. He could not let this opportunity pass. Despite his hollow gut, the first one proved very difficult. When he felt the tiny legs moving within his mouth, he gagged and spit the beetle in the snow. Its aimless kicking made him want to be sick. But a moment later he snatched it up again, then chewed and swallowed it as quickly as he could. The beetle's texture was that of a delicate, slightly flexible nutshell, the taste little more than a musty tang. When an hour had passed, with none of Rachel's dire predictions coming to pass, Simon began to watch the ground carefully, in hope of a few more such slow-moving morsels. Different than his great hunger, and in some ways worse, was the continuing cold. When he could find and devour a fistful of lootgrass, his hunger was for a moment made less, and when he had hiked the first morning hour, his muscles stopped aching for a short time. But after that initial moment, when he first crawled into his forest bed, he was never warm again. When he ceased moving even for a few short moments, he began to shiver uncontrollably. The chill was so relentless that it began to seem that it pursued him like an enemy. He cursed at it weakly, swinging his arms through the air as though the malevolent cold was something he could strike, as he had struck at the dragon Ikjarjuk. But cold was everywhere and nowhere. It had no black blood to spill. There was nothing that Simon could do but walk. So, during all the painful hours of daylight, from the time his cramped limbs forced him from his makeshift bed each morning to the hour when the sun finally withdrew from the sodden grey sky, he walked almost ceaselessly southward. The rhythm of his shuffling feet became as much a part of the cycle of life as the rise and fall of the wind, the passage of the sun, the settling of snowflakes. He walked because it kept him warm. He walked south because he dimly remembered Binnabik saying that the Stone of Farewell stood in the grasslands south of Aldeorta. He knew he could never survive a journey through the entire forest, a passage across a vast nation of trees and snow. But he had to have some destination. The endless tramping was easier if all he had to do was let the occluded sun pass from his left to his right. He also walked because when he stood still, the cold began to bring strange, frightening visions. Sometimes he saw faces in the contorted trunks of trees and heard voices speaking his name and the names of strangers. Other times the snowy forest seemed a thicket of towers. The sparse greenery was transformed into leaping flames, and his heart tolled in his ears like a doomful bell. But most importantly, Simon walked because there was nothing else he could do. If he did not keep moving, he would die, and Simon was not ready to die.
"But now, don't run, don't flitter, taste bitter. Don't care, don't care. Bug stay, happy day, tasty bite. Don't fight."
It was late morning, the seventh day since his awakening. Simon was stalking. A spotted brown and grey beetle, larger and possibly more succulent than the small black variety which he had made a staple of his diet, was picking its way across the trunk of a white cedar. Simon had snatched at it once, some 20 ells back, but this beetle had wings, and surely that proved its tastiness, since it had to work so hard to remain uneaten, and had gone humming away most ungracefully. It had not flown far. A second attempt had also failed, which had led to this most recent landing place. He was singing to himself. Whether he sang out loud or not, he didn't know. The beetle didn't seem to mind, so Simon kept it up.
"Beetle, sleep! Don't creep! Trust me! Stand still! Stand still! Tasty crumb! Here I come! Through the snow! Don't go!"
Simon, his eyes screwed down in a hunter's squint, was moving as slowly as his trembling, ill-nourished body would permit. He wanted this beetle. He needed this beetle. Feeling a shiver beginning to well up inside of him, a shiver that would spoil his careful approach, he lunged. His palms slapped eagerly against the bark, but when he brought his cupped hands up to his face to peer within, he saw that he held nothing.
"What do you want it for?"
someone asked. Simon, who had carried on more than a few conversations with strange voices during these last days, had already opened his mouth to reply, when his heart suddenly began hammering in his chest. He whirled, but no one was there. "Now it's begun. The going mad has begun," was all he had time to think before someone tapped him on his shoulder. He spun again and almost fell down.
"Here, I caught it."
The beetle, curiously lifeless, hovered in the air before him. A moment later he saw that it hung from the fingers of a white-gloved hand. The hand's owner stepped out from behind the cedar tree.
"I don't know what you will do with it. Do your people eat these things? I had never heard that."
For a brief instant he thought Jariki had come. The golden-eyed face was framed by a cloud of pale lavender hair, Jariki's own odd shade, and feathered braids hung beside each upslanting cheekbone. But after a long, staring instant, he realized it was not his friend. The stranger's face was very slender, but still slightly rounder than Jariki's. As with the prince, the alien architecture made some of this Scyther's expressions seem cold or cruel, or even faintly animalistic, yet still strangely beautiful. The newcomer seemed younger and more unguarded than Jariki. Her face, he had just realized that the stranger was female, changed swiftly from expression to expression even as he watched, like an exchange of subtle masks. Despite what seemed the fluidity and energy of youth, Simon saw that deep in the cat-calm, golden eyes, this stranger shared with Jariki the ancient Scythi light.
"Siomen,"
she said, then laughed whisperingly. Her white-clad finger touched his brow, light and strong as a bird's wing.
"Siomen, Snowlock."
Simon was quivering.
"Who?" "Aditu."
Her eyes were faintly mocking.
"My mother named me Aditu Nosaunsere. I have been sent for you."
"Sent? By?" Aditu tilted her head to one side, stretching her neck sinuously, and regarded Simon as someone might an untidy but interesting animal that crouched on the doorstep.
"By my brother, man-child. By Jariki, of course."
She stared as Simon began to sway gently from side to side.
"Why do you look so strange?"
"Were you in my dreams?" he asked plaintively. She continued to watch curiously as he abruptly sat down in the snow, beside her bare feet.
"Certainly,
I have boots,
Aditu said later. Somehow she had built a fire, scraping away the snow and stacking the wood right beside the spot where Simon had crumpled, then igniting it with some swift movement of her slender fingers. Simon stared intently into the flames, trying to make his mind work properly once more.
I just wanted to take them off so I could approach more quietly.
She eyed him blandly.
I did not know what it was that could make such a blundering noise. But it was you, of course. Still, there is something fine about the feel of snow on the skin.
Simon shuddered, thinking of ice against bare toes.
How did you find me?
The mirror. Its song is very powerful.
So if I had lost the mirror, you wouldn't have found me?
Aditu looked at him solemnly.
Oh, I would have found you, eventually. But mortals are frail creatures. There might not have been much of interest left to find.
She flashed her teeth in what he guessed was a smile. She seemed both more and less human than Jiriki, almost childishly flippant at times, but in other ways far more exotic and alien than her brother. Many of the traits Simon had observed in Jiriki, the feline grace and dispassion, seemed even more pronounced in his sister. As Simon rocked back and forth, still not absolutely sure he was awake and sane, Aditu reached inside her white coat, which with her white breeches had made her all but indistinguishable against the snow, had removed a package wrapped in shiny cloth. She handed it to him. He poked clumsily at the wrappings for some time before he was able to expose what was inside. A loaf of golden brown bread that seemed oven fresh, and a handful of fat pink berries. Simon had to eat his meal in very small bites to avoid making himself ill. Even so, each less than a mouthful seemed like time spent in paradise.
Where did you find these?
He asked through a faceful of berries. Aditu looked at him for a long time, as if debating some important decision. When she spoke,